Shalom. Welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is the program of the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co or follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end where we always have an exciting opportunity for you, and please feel free to share this with others who will also find it important. Today, we're recording a specific important conversation, and I honestly only noticed the significance of the date. We're recording this conversation on August 7th, which is exactly 22 months since the Hamas attack and massacre of October 7th of 2023, and 670 days since that. Some call it a war, some say it's a battle in the ongoing war of independence that Israel's been fighting since 1948. And today with us, even though you don't see them, I have three reservist soldiers who have spent, each of them individually and collectively, most of the last 670 days in reserves in one capacity or another. And we don't see them because of the nature of their missions, but we also don't see them because of the perverted nature that the world has become, demonizing Israel and Israelis wherever we are in the world, and specifically hunting, and I use that word deliberately, hunting Israeli soldiers. So we're here to have a conversation, a candid conversation, but not to reveal who the nature of who we're speaking to, and certainly don't want to put them compromising anything militarily or compromising them and their families. And it's important that we have this conversation, I would say, especially now, because by the time you're hearing this or seeing this conversation, it may very well be that there are new trial balloons, new things being talked about. But where we stand right now, 670 days into this war, is that there are still 50 hostages. Israel still does not control all of Gaza, and Hamas still is in control of portions of Gaza where the hostages are believed, or at least many of them believed to be. And we, as Israel, have made public declarations, and I'd like to talk about that at some point, that now we're going to be fully taking over Gaza. I've been struggling with why even those comments are being made, because in my sense, and I'm not a military person, you don't need to announce your intent to do something. You just need to go do it. Today, I'm with three men, one who I'm just meeting for the first time, Robert, David, who I have met and I have known of from a different situation that we're going to talk about, and Shachak, with whom I've had the privilege of working over the last year and a half, who has been helping us get support to soldiers, encouragement, life-saving equipment, both to help keep people safe, but also most important, I think, to let people know that they are encouraged by the support of people from overseas, and in our case, specifically Christians. So I want to I'm going to ask the three to introduce themselves, a little about who you are, your family status, what you're doing in the military. If you were not native Israeli born, tell us a little bit about your background. And let's start with you, Robert, since we're only meeting for the first time today.
Pleasure to be here, Jonathan. It's nice to meet you as well. So a bit about myself. You might be able to notice it from my accent, but I'm originally from Germany. This is where I was born and raised, and came a number of years ago to Israel to join the army, and then eventually got married and decided to stay in Israel. So I'm married with one son, And we live for a number of years now in a moshav that is on the border with Lebanon, a few hundred meters away from the border. In the army, as a reservist, I serve in a unit that specializes on the Northern Theater of Operations, and that is with Lebanon, Hezbollah, and focusing on the Hadwan unit within Hezbollah in particular. We were the first combat unit that was operational on October 7 in the Northern Theater of Operations. And that morning, and maybe I'll keep it at this for now, and we can discuss more going forward.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. David, long before I met you, I knew about you. I'm a big admirer, also as Robert, you as well, as an immigrant. It's not easy to pick up and move and leave things behind, even if we're coming here for a much greater purpose. But David, you were also, I'm just going to put it out there now, we'll come back and talk about it, but I read about you first. You can tell me, remind me how long ago it was, but you were involved in a terror attack where you were wounded, thank God only wounded. But tell us about you.
Okay, great to be here. I grew up in the U.S. I served as a U.S. Marine when I was 18. After my service in the Marines, I made Aliyah in 2002. And ever since, I've been here in Israel, different places, mostly in the Shomron, in Samaria. And since I came, I've been involved in special operations here in Israel, both on the operational level, as well as a lot of teaching to many different units. I'm married with four kids. So yeah, that's my bio in a nutshell. The terror attack happened about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago already.
Did that, other than physically, you mentioned that you still have an injury from that. I won't go into it unless you want to, but I'm just curious how if it's just over 2 years ago, you were injured in a terror attack before the war began, and then all of a sudden we're in a war and you're in special operations. How did that impact you at the time?
Yeah. So my feeling about it, my experience, trauma is something which unfolds over a long period of time. And sometimes it's years until you start to understand the impact of different events that happened even years ago. So there's no question that the terror attack had on the one hand, I would say it was a tremendous trauma. You know, I was in critical condition. On the other hand, it was a great blessing, you know, to kind of see and understand that life is extremely precious. Take each day as a gift. So I view it as a great blessing as well.
Are the terrorists who attack you still consuming oxygen?
Yes, he was saved. I wounded him in response. I shot back and wounded him. He was treated by the IDF and saved, and he's in prison now.
Which is a whole separate conversation for another time, as it relates to our hostage deals that we end up getting in and releasing prisoners, and that would be and we've done that. That's also got to be in the back of your mind. Shachak, we've known each other for a while. I remember that day you ended up becoming the spokesman, me hosting a group of people from Atlanta. And we've done a lot of interesting, fun, meaningful things together. Share a little bit about yourself for everyone who doesn't have the privilege of knowing you like I do.
Well, hi, guys. First of all, thank you for the kind word, Baha. I was just an ordinary electrician, actually. And I was called on October 7th from 7:30 in the morning, being a part of the Gaza, the patrol unit in the Gaza Club. We met you like about several months afterwards. And at the time, all I was concerned about is making the world know what's going on here, because it's It's not a local issue. We were like, we couldn't believe that people cannot see it for what it is and look at it as a war between Israel and Gaza, although Gaza is in the country. And we're not fighting the Gazans. So, yeah, this is how we met. And, yeah, I'm still serving today. Although I was injured in February, I was 2 years in recovery. And then I was back in the field.
2 years in recovery?
2 months.
2 months. Okay, I'm going to clarify. And you're married and you have three kids, yeah?
I'm married with three kids.
A couple of dogs?
Yep. She was a dog. She passed away during this. Oh. But not until I got home to say goodbye.
You just opened the conversation October 7th. You were called up. I assume, and Robert, you mentioned it as well. Just talk about the beginning of that. You're all seasoned. You're not young 18, 19, 20 year old men doing their what's it called? Mandatory service. You're older men with families. What happened that day? Specifically as it relates to you and your family. Robert, you were already on the northern border and you stayed active at Lebanon. Ariel, I know you were in why don't we start with Robert, because let's stick with the north where it wasn't quite as active, at least according to my awareness.
Yeah, so fortunately we didn't have to experience in the north what I was experiencing in the south. My unit was, by the way, created because they thought that October 7 would happen from the north. It was, of course, a heavy miscalculation. And we're very fortunate it didn't happen, because if it had, I probably wouldn't be here today. I think it's public knowledge now that the force distribution on the border was heavily favoring enemy positions. It's like the Napoleon's old adage, right, that if you want to have a chance at winning an offensive battle, right, you want a force ratio of 3-1, and that's more or less what they had, right, against us. We were called up. We first was first indication that we might be called up at, I think, 7:30 in the morning. And then an hour and a half later, we then received the formal order, and because of I was so close, I could respond within less than 15 minutes. I was there on base with the first ones to respond. And at the time, it took a couple of hours to be really ready, mainly because our firearms were in a safe on the base. And
which is the same way that the communities on the Gaza border had problems. They all had to go get their arms, and they were snipers ready to take care of that.
Absolutely. Right. So that was at the time. Nowadays, it's not the case anymore. We have them all at home. But at the time, that was definitely the case. And also up here, significantly delayed, right, the operational readiness. And I still have a picture where I saw our Rafshas, that means the security coordinator of our Moshav, come out of the same base, right, with his pickup truck loaded with 30 rifles in the back, right, to bring it to the standby squad in the Moshav. But it took a couple of hours for that to happen, right? If they would have surprised us, we would have been caught without ways to defend ourselves at the time.
Was it public knowledge then that the Hezbollah forces outnumbered the Israeli troops 3-1?
Afterwards, like in the public inquiries, right, at came out, but it always, everybody knew, right, that our we probably didn't have sufficient forces up north. Okay. Force distribution is not the only thing, right? But also, as October 7th taught us, right, you can't rely on advanced intelligence and other measures of force effectiveness, right, to balance that out.
So on October 7th, you went to base. Was there, and I'm not aware of this, was there an actual any combat in Lebanon at that time, or the purpose was to be defensive and be prepared?
I want to pause in the conversation for just a moment to invite you to join us in one of the really incredible programs that we do as part of the Genesis 123 Foundation. This year, we have been going out all throughout the Judean Mountains to show love to soldiers who are stationed keeping us safe from the threat of terrorism. It doesn't matter if we're in a burning heat wave or temperatures below freezing before the wind chill, they are out there guarding strategic points that have a high risk of terrorism. And thanks to the support of many people like you, we are pleased to bring them homemade hot soup in the cold of winter and cold drinks and sweet watermelon in the heat of summer. Any donation is meaningful and helps us to bless the soldiers. You can join us and donate at genesis123.co/blessasoldier. That's genesis123.co/blessasoldier. And when you do, you also have the opportunity to send along your own personal words of thanks and blessings to the soldiers guarding the land and protecting the people. Please join us.
On the first day, it was preparing for to counter to counterattack if in the event of an infiltration. As I mentioned, we were the first units that came there to support the unit already on the border. And I remember coming to one kibbutz that is literally on the border, right, and meeting with the security coordinator there, and that was midday. And he said he hadn't seen any sign of the army, right, this entire time. It took a little while, right, for Hezbollah, which was also surprised, right, to attack.
About the Hamas attack.
Sorry?
They were surprised by the Hamas attack.
Yes, right. If they would have coordinated their efforts, we would have been in a quite bad place. They didn't launch quite a large-scale invasion like they had planned, right? As in the invasion of the Galilee plan. But it did start, right, with mortar attacks, with rocket attacks, with anti-tank missiles, Kornets, right? A month in, there's actually a footage of Hezbollah shooting at within one of the Mushavim, and from the corner of the video footage, you can see the plot of land that I bought just a few months ago beforehand. So it's very much right the defense of the home, and there were also a couple of infiltration attempts, right, marginally successful. That means they were able to cross, right, at different points on the border, they were all by that time repelled, and none of them were large scale. We're talking about smaller squads of 4 to 5 operators, and mainly, by the way, Palestinians. So, and not official
Palestinians, not Hezbollah.
Yeah,
interesting.
The assessment was that Hezbollah was saving their fighters, their more trained fighters, right, for a different battle.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for that. David, I have no idea where you were on October 7th, but I imagine you were busy.
I was. So on October 7th, in the morning hours, when we started to get the picture of the scale of what was going on, the initial assessment was that my area, of Samaria, would also be attacked by large groups of terrorists. So in the morning hours, I spoke to my unit, which I fall under. They were not organized at all. They were not ready to officially draft us for bureaucratic reasons. So in the morning hours, I was trying to push to go into my unit, but they were not ready. They were kind of caught with their pants down a little bit. So we were trying to organize in my area. So I spent the October 7th in Samaria. We were basically putting out all kinds of guards and volunteers, armed volunteers in posts all around perimeters around all of the towns in Samaria. I was only drafted to my unit at the end of October 8th. Oh. So October 8th, I went into my base. And on the 9th, we went down south for kind of mop-up operations, which lasted for a few days. And then we started just to prepare for what we thought would be a quick invasion into Gaza. But that initial invasion didn't come for a few weeks.
When you say a quick invasion, you mean that it was imminent, or do you mean that there was a strategy that it was supposed to go, we were supposed to go in, get the hostages, finish the job, and come out quickly?
No, I mean that I thought it would have happened immediately. We thought that we would enter immediately into Gaza, and we were basically just in preparation mode. And we were sure that we'd be going into Gaza within 1 or 2 days. But that didn't happen for quite a while, a few weeks.
Was that a good thing or a bad thing that it didn't happen for quite a while from your perspective?
I think looking backwards, it was a bad decision. I'm sure that the brass had reasons in terms of, the entire country was caught off guard. And I'm sure that they had a preparation to do in terms of getting people drafted, getting units equipped. That was, not a small matter. So I'm sure that on that level, there were reasons for what they did. But I also believe that if we would have eaten Gaza and took control, I think we would have found a lot more hostages in those initial days.
A lot more hostages and a lot more living hostages.
And a lot more living hostages, absolutely.
Yeah. And so when you did go in, you were there. Were you in the first wave of people who went in?
Yes. Yes, I was.
Where'd you go? What'd you do?
So I have to, I wasn't so, I've done so many tours and I have to remember because I was basically everywhere, but I was in northern Gaza in the beginning. Jabalia, Saja'ia are two of the names. I was in Gaza City, many, many places.
Okay.
And so, many of those, bordering one another. And you almost don't even know that you're crossing from one into the other sometimes. So.
Like being in northern
Gaza. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. As a former resident of northern New Jersey, that's my analogy. When you drive from one town to the next and you don't even recognize you've left one because they've just, they all blend into each other. So good call. Shahak, my vision of Israel on October 7th is largely created from the times you and I have spent together bringing people down. I don't want to forget, and I'm not going to necessarily volunteer Robert and David to jump in for this, but I know that any time that I'm able to bring somebody, matter of fact, there's a pastor coming from Texas in a couple of weeks. I think we've made a connection and you're going to be hosting him. But when you do come here, and rather than just going and doing the touristy stuff, if you want to see and be engaged with what's going on, we've been doing a lot of that. And Shahak, you've been in many ways my eyes and mouth on helping people understand. And when I go down to the Gaza border myself, I'm often reliving your experiences, as silly as that may sound, through the explanations and the places that you showed me where you were in combat that day. But why don't you paint the picture for us as well, October 7th, and then we're going to move to what's going on now.
Well, bravo. Quick bravo. Yeah, if we have to do it, so I was called because...
Can you speak a little bit more into the microphone? It's hard to hear you.
We switch microphones. Let's look at it.
Okay.
Now you don't hear me well?
Not so much. I hear you.
Not so much. Just a second. It's better now?
Yes, much.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I was called on October 7th, 7:30 in the morning. My superior officer called me and told me that we might have been breached and to get to the rain junction. Well, not much to go with. We didn't know the spirit. So I didn't know what we were facing. I just put my gear and head out. I was delayed with an hour with some house this year. It opened the drain. It was plugged. Was headed down south with all my gear. I'm also serving in other units, so I had my guns with me and equipment and everything. So I was ready. I didn't have to find anything in the way. On my way down south around Ashkelon, I picked up the two service that were also called. I never met them before. They had no guns, no uniforms, no anything. Young reservists, never saw combat. They were about 24. We kept going south towards Gazana. All of this time, the only thing we knew was that there were rocket attacks. That was the only thing that, the only time we ever thought that there might be terrorists is when we got to the Admiral Defy Junction and we saw dead bodies lying on the road. And we were trying to contact the police and everything. No one answered. We pulled them aside, covered them, and we had to keep going. And about 50 minutes afterwards, was our first running first, where we realized that there's actually terrorists across the border. At the time, because we were called for the breach, and then we talked about three terrorists, we got them. That was it. And then when we kept going, we realized that it's not just that. Told them, guys, we're in animal territory. Gave them a short briefing. When we kept going, we had many more running into service all the way. I was almost killed. I was shot in the scope of my rifle at the gate of the Negev junction, Shava Negev. And then we kept going until we got to Tomas Lane. Took us, usually it's a half an hour drive. Took us, we get to Yadmur Defy at 10 in the morning. We get to Tomas Lane about 4:30 in the afternoon. It was an unreal day. Doesn't seem realistic, although I've been there. She took part in it. I never believed I'll survive it. Hard to get into details, but we separated in Ulin, and I kept going. I met my guy in another place in Belfast, and we kept going. And, regarding to what Dave said, this night, like on the night between the 7th and the 8th, I rushed home and gave away munition trying to get the people ready because I was sure it will break loose over there as well.
You were sure what? I didn't hear. It's very hard to hear. And for everyone following, I apologize with the audio, but it's a bit of a strain to understand what you're saying.
Sorry. Maybe... a second.
It's good stuff, but but I don't think people are able to follow.
Is it better now?
Yes. Now, whatever you're doing at the moment, don't stop doing it.
Okay. So what I was saying is we were sure it won't be a local thing. That it will be in Judea and Samaria and up north and everything. We felt like all hell broke loose. You hear me better now?
Yeah. Keep going.
Okay. And next following days, we were trying to realize what actually happened. Only that evening, we realized that my people, at least, realized that the communities were attacked and the bases that were fallen, that were taken over. And so we were starting to get it back, to rescue people, to evacuate people, to search the Veltef is an agricultural piece of land. So it's all of it, it's avocados and all sorts of farming area. So it's very easy to hide in. Very easy to survive for long periods of time. Between the trees, they have fruits, they have everything they need.
David, were you in the midst of this as well at that time?
Yeah. It took us about 3 days to have the big parts ready and another month or so to verify all the rest of it. We didn't take part in the first wave of entering Gaza. At the beginning, it was what Dave says is very accurate, that we were sure that any day we're going to take over Gaza, like in a one big move. And then there were all sorts of plans, and it changed all the time. There was a lot of uncertainty. And it only started in a limited capacity a few weeks later. All this time we were working with the communities. We were still finding terrorists, dead bodies all over the place. I think the last dead body we found was 2.5 months after the 7th. And the last terrorist we met was about 1.5 months.
This year, you can join Christian leaders from around the world who are lining up to participate in Root and Branch, the newest hands-on, meaningful, an incredibly tangible way for Christians to make a personal connection to Israel, the Israeli people, and to be a blessing to the people and nation which is still suffering from the trauma of a horrific terrorist attack and war. Root and Branch offers unique comfort and a vision of peace, with tangible material benefits to Israelis who have suffered the trauma of war, specifically in and around the Gaza border area. Root and Branch is a unique agricultural pilgrimage. You will harvest wild olive trees in communities along the Gaza border that were devastated by the October 7, 2023 terrorist attack and massacre. In these communities and elsewhere, we will plant deep and lasting roots among Israelis of all backgrounds, making Root and Branch all the more innovative. Since the war began, more than $50 million in crops have been saved by volunteers. Root and Branch is the first such initiative to harvest olives. Proceeds from the olive oil that's being made will directly benefit these devastated communities, making Root and Branch a critical and significant project to bless Israel economically and spiritually in multiple ways. Root and Branch is a partnership between the Genesis 123 Foundation and NewPersia.org. For information, videos, and media about the experience, dates, pricing, and how you can register, please visit rootandbranchisrael.com. Let me step in. I want to fast forward 650 days to where we are. David, I think you've all been in different places. Robert, you were specifically in the north, and that's been a different scenario. But maybe can you each give just a quick assessment of in those theaters in Lebanon? Syria is a separate piece, so we can talk about that if you want. And Gaza, from your perspectives, where do we stand now on 22 months into this war?
I don't mind starting.
Right.
So my you know, without getting into politics and trying to keep it, I would say on the tactical level, many lessons were learned, and we're on a tactical level, we're in a good place. On a strategic level, I don't think so much. I think that maybe this latest move in Gaza will bring us a little bit more in the right direction in terms of a comprehensive, rational strategy. Up to this point, speaking about the Gaza theater, which is where I have more experience, it's very frustrating. You know, I've been in the same houses multiple times on multiple different tours.
Literally.
Literally. So, you know, that kind of situation where, you know, at this point in Gaza, almost every house is booby-trapped. And then we're taking the houses, sweeping the houses, eventually leaving the houses, and then coming back into the houses. So it's very frustrating. And I hope that this next stage is going to, on a strategic level, bring us to a better direction. In terms of the Lebanon theater, I think tactically it was unbelievable. I think also on a strategic level, unfortunately, Israel's never allowed to win completely. We always get to that point where it's almost a knockout, and then there's a ceasefire. So unfortunately, my feeling is in Lebanon as well, that it was just about a knockout, and then we stopped, unfortunately.
Okay. So bringing us close. You said something about Gaza that I wanted to ask. If you've been back to the same houses multiple times and you're talking about entering and cleaning and sweeping, I mean, I've not been. I understand that there's a huge amount of devastation and destruction in Gaza. But what you're telling me also is that not every home and building is being demolished. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say most of the buildings that I were in had damage, but there are still buildings standing, and more so, there are entire neighborhoods that have never been entered.
And that's because?
So, the assumption is because they assume that there are hostages there.
And to enter would mean, even though the objective is to rescue the hostages, the entering of those neighborhoods would put the 20 remaining living ones' lives at risk.
Yeah, that's my assumption.
Okay. Shahak, Robert, you want to jump in with your assessment? Thank you for that, David. Where we are in any theater?
I would love to. I haven't been to Lebanon as much. Did some Lebanon, some Syria, but mostly Gaza. And I handle the field that they've just mentioned. The IED profession. Okay. And we have to understand who are the hostages in order to understand this. The hostages are first the Gazans, and good, then also ours. But the Gazans have been occupied by Hamas for the past 20 years, thinking it's a democracy is just misleading everyone. And they are the first and foremost victims of the Hamas and all of this. Now, Hamas doesn't see himself as a part of Gaza. They see themselves as the king of Gaza, the ruler. They control everything. They have tax over everything. And they are extremely reckless with human lives. They don't even count it to this level. Now, understanding this, then we can understand what we're facing. They don't mind sacrificing their own people. Sure, not their belongings, their homes, their neighborhoods, everything. And we saw amazing differences between the Hamas areas when we first stepped in and the usual Gaza. Just like Sao Paulo, for example, in Brazil, we have the favelas for the normal people, and the rich folks that live behind the wall have a pool and a villa and everything. And that was like the Hamas quarters up north versus the normal people like 500 meters away. And you can see also in the tunnels that we see extreme poverty on top and then absolute riches 50 meters down in the sand. And therefore, actually our hostages are getting better treatment from Hamas than any other person in Gaza.
That's a really shocking statement, considering the videos that were released this week.
AI does amazing work. You know?
The videos of Evyatar David are not real?
Of ours, yeah. But they do a lot of AI.
Okay.
The guys I want for nothing. And I think it's quite ridiculous giving them what's called humanitarian aid when we're the victim. Because where's our humanitarian aid, you know? But our hostages, they keep them alive, not beyond this. They want the shock. This whole attack on us is actually a test to the, for the free world to see just how bad they can do. And they did their worst. And they have a fruitful imagination. And they did the absolute worst they could imagine. And try and see how bad they can do and still get support from the free world, allegedly free. Israel is not the victor, like not the main thing in this attack. And this attack is the only the beginning, so I believe. And I think the Muslim countries were the first to wake up. One of them is Lebanon. Syria, but they're afraid to do it.
Well, where do we stand with the war here now, 22 months in, from your perspective? And you also have been spending most of your time in Gaza, where as of this week there have been public declarations of Israel formally taking over Gaza. I don't know what that means.
All a public declaration can say is that it will not happen.
Say that again?
All a public declaration can say in war is that we don't want to do it.
Interesting.
If we want to do it, we would just do it. The problem is being anticipated. Our moral standards make us extremely predictable. Which equals dead soldiers. Because they don't fight like an army, they don't fight fairly, it's the opposite. Right? They don't, they hope to die in an action, but they don't always succeed. It's a whole other culture.
Right.
So for us to be predictable is a death sentence.
So let me pivot. And go to Robert. David, you mentioned earlier, I don't remember what word you used, but I nodded in terms of the success in Lebanon. And Robert, you had in your initial comments made an observation that was the, if you will, October 7th, that was the attack that was being prepared for. Clearly, Israel was preparing for something, albeit that our troops were outnumbered the way you're saying that they were. Obviously, that's not part of being prepared. But what was revealed in terms of some very precise actions, I don't know if you to what extent you were involved with any, but the beepers and the text message, the same thing, and the walkie talkies, and knowing precisely where things and people are, and taking it out. All of that said, it seems to me that Hezbollah is still a much more of a standing threat and has been hit less significantly than Hamas, which still is a standing threat. What's your sense on where we are today vis-a-vis Hezbollah in Lebanon specifically, but feel free to make any other comments. We haven't even spoken about Iran.
Right. And Hezbollah is also connected to Iran, of course. Right. I think on one hand, the good news is that after October 7 and the year after that, every contact we had with Hezbollah operatives, we faced an enemy that was very professional, very skilled, well organized, very capable. Yeah. And now we can say that this is not the case anymore. Yeah. So the tide has a significant shift. As far as what you mentioned there, I'll concur there with David, saying that these are mainly like tactical achievements, right? With very significant, right? About strategically speaking, and more short-term gains that opened the way for a lot of other actions that happened thereafter. On the less good news, right? I think it's no secret, right? That when the quote-unquote ceasefire, right? There was put in as a result of international politics and not a result of the military assessing that a job was done there. Right? I'll tell us that us on the ground, we were very frustrated because we felt that we had that much more work to do there. Right? At a very simple level, it was like search and destroy missions to impact the infrastructure, weapon caches, and the sort. Just a week beforehand, we had uncovered massive cache with foxholes, positions, right, that was designed with everything you needed to have a suppressive fire position against one of the kibbutzim on the border, right? And there's more left, right? So we left kind of with the feeling that we hadn't completed the job. That we had not completed the job. A bit, if you're a firefighter, right, and you're, in the military, we're in the business of eliminating threats, right? That's our profession here when we are in uniform, right? We're there to prevent, right, the ability of any hostile elements, right, to cause harm, right? So, like, if you take a firefighter metaphor, right, and you have a fire and you have to extinguish the fire, right? It felt a bit like, not just a bit, but like you're extinguishing most of it, but the core, the source of the fire, you leaving a glimmer. Right.
Wow.
Really the potential for it to ignite again. And although, to a very limited extent, it's also publicly available that there's still some activity going on, right? That fire, we're letting it burn, and slowly over time, right, it will come back again, right? This is the long-term perspective, at least the way I see it. There's no doubt about it that we are in a, strategically speaking, in a much better situation than we were before October 7. This is extremely significant. But by the way, also not just because of what we did, right? I think one of the most strategic, most impactful strategic developments was the fall of Assad in Syria and closing the supply line, the lifeline of Hezbollah, right, from Iran to Hezbollah. That's the strategic element that significantly weakened the organization on top of what we did.
It's not a direct consequence, and it wasn't something that Israel necessarily had anything to do with, and nor if Israel were to bring down the Assad regime, would they necessarily put in a former Al-Qaeda leader. It's kind of ironic how that's come to place.
Right. I mean, there's, you can have positive developments coming out of, from bad happenings as well, right? So there are a lot of risks with what is happening in Syria right now, right? If we talk about Lebanon, right, and as far as Hezbollah concerned, what happened in Syria is a positive development on that front, right? It opens a whole other area of potential threats, right, on the Syrian side long term. But that's another topic, I think. So that's in short our assessment, and I think that I wouldn't be surprised, right, the way that Hezbollah is being cornered also domestically, right? If in the not so distant future, we might see limited attempts, right, by Hezbollah to flare things up again.
Okay. I want to begin to wrap up. I'm realizing that, you know, this is a conversation that could and should go on for hours, and maybe one day, not even recording, but certainly if people are coming to visit, we can sit at a barbecue or over coffee or shachak, as you and I did a few weeks back in a cafe in Sderot, spending a couple of hours together with some other combat soldiers who also have been spending a lot of time. We're now, I mean, in the world, I think it's a fair statement that there's no good news that's coming out of Gaza. I did see today, coincidentally, Robert, that one or two German publications have now called out the fake images that have been recently spread from Gaza, and they're going to be a little bit more circumspect in what they use and whose source they use. But very little good news from Gaza that's in the world. What do you want to say to that? The war is not over. It's not far from over. And we're now 22 months in. And in a blink of an eye, we're going to be beginning the third year of this since October 7th of 23. As men who spent, tell me if I'm wrong, perhaps more time away from your family than with your family in the last 22 months, or certainly a whole large part of it, what do you need the world to understand about the war and continuing to persecute the war, and why? Or do you think, no, it's time to pack up and count your losses and walk away so there's no more losses? Anyone who wants to jump in.
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better. Much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds, just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones.
So I was speaking earlier about strategic versus tactical thinking.
Yeah.
And I think that it touches on the strategic. My feeling is that the current war has at least three fronts. There's the Iranian Hezbollah front. There's the Muslim Brotherhood Sunni Hamas front. Obviously, they have connections. And then there's the public relations war, which is the Qatari front. And I feel that Israel is missing the boat on that front of the war, which might be the most important front of the war. I feel like Israel at this point doesn't even realize that we have a war on that front. And I think that until
we treat it, even 22 months in, you don't think that we realize that we're being attacked there?
No, I think that Israel is still trying to play by the same elder of Hasbara of sending out people to try to explain what we're doing and why we're doing it. I think it's a failed attempt. I think that we have to understand that there are many, many billions of dollars that are going into this front, into this war. And if we don't meet it and match it, we'll never succeed on this front. We're not going to convince, or we're not going to come out positively in a media which is being funded on that level and where agendas are being pushed on that level unless we fight it as a battle front. That's my take.
Not being outnumbered 3-1, as Robert said, using the example on the Lebanese border.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And what is, okay, if we're talking about media and what's being publicized. So the other element to that, of course, is a population that's willing, jumping to receive all that, to embrace the misinformation. David, before we let Shahak jump in, what's the one singular biggest piece of misinformation in the last 22 months?
Wow, that's quite a challenging question. Well, the one piece.
You can use a shotgun and hit one.
Yeah. I think the entire narrative from the very beginning, from its inception, is a in Europe and the US that there was a country called Palestine is unified. I think it all begins there.
Shahak, you're going to jump in before.
Yeah. We are the occupiers of our own indigenism, as a wise man once said. So, I just wanted to say that I think the people have to understand this isn't a war between nations, it's not over ground, it's not over resources or anything. This is a holy war waged against us being the free people, the free world, not Jews or Israelis, it's everyone. And it's not a local thing. And this is truly a war between good and evil. When we end up taking care of their people, being the Gazans, the refugees, and they're trying to eliminate just everyone stands in their way. And people just have to open their eyes, learn a bit, because I think this war is fundamentally based on ignorance, misunderstanding, and let's say trying to be politically correct.
Wait, I want to stop you a second. The war is based on ignorance, misunderstanding, and trying to be politically correct. Does that mean if people were not ignorant and there was not misunderstanding and we had no political correctness, that our enemies would not be trying to slaughter us and yell from the river to the sea and intifada, intifada?
Nothing of it. The only reason a Muslim wages a holy war against the heretic, us being the heretics, is because the enemy is weak. Because we let them speak out, because we let them openly promote Sharia law, which is, the only way to promote it is by not knowing what it means. Because it means lying to the heretics, being us, raping our women because it doesn't count since they're not Muslims, and so many more things. It goes to business, it goes to everything. They don't have to follow the same nation's law while they're under Sharia. They are only committed to the Sharia, which is supposed to be Islam, but isn't based on Islam. It's just evil. So I think the free world, in order to remain free and to be able to remain a democracy, must know who they're dealing with and what it means to surrender in this case.
So I'm going to use an interesting analogy. Who mentioned Robert? It was you being a firefighter and leaving before all the flames are extinguished. So,
or a dentist.
I lost my train of thought. It was a good comment I was going to make. A 12-step program. People know about 12 steps, addictions. And one of the first, my first job in Israel, I worked for the Israel Anti-Drug Authority. I learned more about substance abuse and addiction and recovery in that short period than I had ever known in all of my 40 years before that. But the first step in recovery is you have to acknowledge the problem. And Shachak, what you're saying, it makes complete sense. But the world, excluding most of Israel, and pockets around in other parts of the world, doesn't understand it, doesn't get that very basic truism that this is a fight of good versus evil, and it's as much their fight as it is our fight, even though, as the German, I believe, chancellor said, that we're the ones during the war with Iran, we're the ones doing the world's dirty work. So if that's a reasonable analogy, how do we get the world to step up and first at least acknowledge that there's that problem?
Say, you mean without being murdered in the streets?
Well, but okay, yeah. Today, 22 months, because every month that goes by, they're also gaining ground around the world. They're occupying territory physically, and they're occupying people's brains. And once it's in there, it's very hard to undo that. So I thought it was remarkable, for instance, that the German papers this week said, no, those are fake images and we will not sanction that and we will not use those. But very few people, other than those who care about Israel and certainly not those who should be representing journalistic integrity, have acknowledged even that basic truism. How do you get a world that's under attack to realize it?
I have to say that I enjoyed the fact that Hamas was making fake images, because they're not shy of making real images. You know, I saw them in the last round in 20, what was it? Protective Edge. What year was it? I think 10 years ago.
2014.
I saw 14, them. 11, 11, yeah.
I saw them create real images. I saw them execute Gazan kids in order to make a picture as if we killed them. So I would prefer for them to make fake images. Okay? But beyond that, I think that the only way for the free world to see the problem is first opening their eyes and not judging the other man, the other people, the other culture through their own eyes. Because all a European normal person or American or Israeli or Western, let's say, wants when he wakes in the morning is to get back home in the evening, have a decent work, be able to provide for his family. And we want to believe that everyone everywhere is like that. And it's just false. Okay? It's completely different culture. We cannot create equations that doesn't exist in real life. Like quiet will be answered with quiet. If your enemy is quiet, all it means is that it's getting ready. It's getting bigger. He's preparing for the next step. Anything short from an absolute surrender with no conditions can be interpreted as a victory against a religious fanatic. Not necessarily a Muslim, but now it's a Muslim.
Okay. That's a little bit long for a bumper sticker, but that should be a bumper sticker.
You can just, I would go with releasing terrorists equals murdering civilians.
Yeah. Okay.
If I had to choose a bumper sticker.
But very good, concise way. And that's something that I want to encourage people to pause this, rewind about a minute, and listen to what Shahak just said in terms of, you know, what's the penultimate issue. Robert, I want to come back to you in the north. Oh, go ahead.
We're going to make Gaza great again.
Okay. Well, that the assumption that is that Gaza was ever great, which we have not seen in...
Actually, before Islam, it used to be the main port for the Nabatis, who used to bring goods from Saudi Arabia at the time. It was the golden age of the Arabs, when they controlled physics, mathematics, metallurgy, lots of stuff.
All right, that's a great analogy. I've written a piece about how I would rebuild Gaza and make it not great again, but okay, I'll buy your Nebatean analogy as someone who lives in multiple centuries. Thank you, Robert. Is it before you kind of give an overview and what people you want the world to know now as we're this seems like the main front, the active front, is Gaza still and will be for the foreseeable future. But it seems to me, you know, just Jonathan sitting here in the Judean mountains, that Lebanon and Hezbollah is still the most dangerous. Forget Iran and what they may or may not be able to do. But it seems like proportionally Hezbollah was hit the least. And that's a and I know my son is it's not my son. I know he's being deployed next month to the north. What's your sense? Where are we? What does the world need to know? If you want to speak specifically about your experience in the north or our war 22 months in general.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you say, I've been mostly focused on the north. Spent since October 7 continuously, I think, until January this year in reserve duty, and since beginning of this year a bit in and out. I completely agree. So Hezbollah, right, is even though it is significantly weakened and we're in the best situation there that we have been in a long time, it's still an organization that continues to survive as an organization with military abilities, right, that can pose a threat that the as far as I see from has capabilities that Hamas at this point in time doesn't currently have. In terms of the way the international community looks at it or the public perception of it, I mean, there was always more understanding for Lebanon, right, than there was for Gaza. At least the people that I care about outside of Israel, right, and that I have discussions with, or that there's much more understanding on that front. Like there's more understanding also for Iran, right? So you mentioned the German chancellor. There's a broad consensus. For Gaza, there's a problem, right, of public opinion, right, and perception, right? And that's one, you know, like the genocide claims and the tying, you know, the support for the Palestinians, right, with the establishment or recognition of a Palestinian state, right? If this is that they always, you know, they will always see this as the ultimate vision for it. But the thought, right, that they could somehow like help the situation, right, help the Palestinians by recognizing a state is erroneous on so many levels, right?
Palestinians, you mean Jordanian refugees?
Sorry?
When you say Palestinians.
Right. I mean, so if you want to talk with, you know, people in Europe, right, North America, right, you have to talk their language, right?
Correct.
And this is the way they say things, right? And you don't have to, right, against the establishment of a Palestinian state or anything, adopt any of these views to be in favor of what Israel is doing in Gaza, right? And I think us connecting the two, right? Like is probably a mistake, right? You can support Israel's actions in Gaza, right? Without, irrespective of your stance of how you think that, a future solution might look like. And oftentimes we make that connection, right? And I think, and we're also inconsistent, right, in our public messaging. And the least consistent you are, right, the less arrives, right? Because then people pick up what they want to pick up, right?
Correct.
I mean, that's my personal.
That's a great observation. Yeah. Gentlemen, there's so much more I wanted to talk about. An hour blew away so quickly. I thought it would, but I didn't think this quickly. And I'd love to reconvene this. I'd love to hope, it's a fantasy, that sooner than later, you'll be able to spend more of your time at home with your families rather than worrying about where you're being called up to and what other actions that there are. First of all, I know on behalf of everyone who's listening, following, we wish for your safety and for the safety of all of the soldiers, and that you will be successful in defeating our enemies and with whatever force or efforts are needed to bring home the hostages. We know that that's forefront on all of your minds and keeping us safe. So I can sit here and go to the Jerusalem Wine Festival on a Thursday night, and others can get their lives. I don't think it can be understated how much we all are grateful to you and should be grateful to you, and the hundreds of thousands of reservists who have also spent, like you, months and months and now almost 2 years in, some of you more than a year or most of 2 years doing reserves. And I want everyone, I think my takeaway, this was completely spontaneous, but my takeaway is that I want everyone listening and following this conversation to listen to what these men have said and hope that we can do it again in person. And if you're bringing a group to Israel, I want you to be in touch and we'll maybe try to make one of these experiences for you personal. But the trickle down, the economic trickle down for families, the tension in terms of married men like the three of you having wives and children to be responsible for, and the unavoidable tension that creates. None of that can be, I don't think any of it is yet quantified sufficiently, and none of it can be overstated. So I know you're all doing your job and think that you're doing your job and you're on board with it, but no one should leave this conversation and recognize that there are not you and hundreds of thousands of others like you who do step up, who will continue to step up at great personal sacrifice for our national well-being. I want to thank you for that.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance to create an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anybody for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit IsraelTheMiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
Maybe one quick last word regarding those who have donated to the projects that we have funded. Just quickly, Robert, the way we started, Robert, David, and Shahak, a lot of the donations we've received from all over the world, the proportionally large number, are coming from Christians. And we don't, they're giving out, they're giving money for life-saving equipment and barbecues and other kinds of things, uniforms, I forget what other, all the other things, but mostly for showing appreciation. So maybe leaving on a positive note. Robert, you first. How does all that love from anonymous people, specifically Christians all over the world, make you feel?
I have to say that it has been one of the most uplifting phenomenon throughout the by serving in the reserves, right? We saw a lot of it right at the beginning of the war, right? And there's a whole literature about, like, you know, crisis and how people react to crisis, right? And it all, you know, if whether it's an earthquake or whatever it is, right, at the beginning we see massive mobilization, right? And then afterwards, but people cannot get used to it, right? And it's like, well, why would you still need this, right? And the fact that now, 22 months, and with Ariel, just last week, right, the fact that this is still happening outside from the value, how it makes our day, or the value it brings us in terms of the equipment, it's that there's still people out there, you know, that support us from so far away that we have never met, right? When we feel frustrated for many reasons, or have our difficulties with family, with work, with or what's happening in the army, it brightens our day and gives us the big component of the strength that helps us continue. And so we're tremendously thankful.
Thanks for sharing that. David, you also met some of the donors when we came to visit you when last time I saw you. How does all that make you feel from this support from overseas?
Yeah, like Robert said, it's an incredible thing to, you know, for us to be going through what we're going through, and then to feel that support from the other side of the world. You know, I'll just tell you, there's really two sides to the support, and I'll, you know, just a quick story. I had just finished a tour in Jabalia, in which we had several wounded people from our unit, and our morale was extremely low. A few of the younger guys in my unit were maybe at the breaking point, and we were taken out of Gaza for one night for a barbecue, which someone donated, and it literally reset us back to the starting point. And we went back a day later, and it's something which seems so minor, but it was such an important event that I think we wouldn't have really succeeded in that tour if it wasn't for that. And then there's the other side, and that's on the morale side. And then on the tactical side, you know, we were doing operations at night, and in the beginning, we only had one person with night vision, so we put him in the front, and we were stumbling around in Gaza, stumbling over rubble in pitch black.
Wow.
Because we just didn't have what we needed. And while it's not 100% complete, it's a totally different situation now. So to describe to you how much it matters, where you're stumbling around, going from stumbling around in the dark over rubble, sharp rubble, to where you can actually see where you're going and understand if there are threats around you. Words can't really even describe how important that is.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing. I want to interject. Shahak, you'll get the last word. I don't remember which event it was that we did, a barbecue or something, where people brought notes that were written by kids from other parts of the world for soldiers. And we've had the occasion in the last 22 months to do quite a lot, and I'm very grateful for the privilege of doing it. But I thought that the notes, it was a lovely thing. It was more of a lovely activity for the kids who were making them than for bringing paper here. And I found that to be mistaken. And even just a handwritten note by a 10-year-old child means a lot. So I mention that because I'd love for anyone to interject who's following this, be in touch, and maybe you can help us not just to send one or two, but you can be a collecting point, and we'll bring over a bunch of notes and inundate the soldiers with love. Shachak, you've been more hands-on in terms of the funds that we've been able to pass through and help provide moral support and nourishment and other things for soldiers. What does that mean? You're usually the one who is orchestrating things, but we don't talk about it as much.
For me, actually, a part of my process is in order to have this experience that I've been through and still going through, let's say, logical in a way, then it has to serve for good. I cannot just let everyone else do the same mistakes and go through the same things that I've been through. And I don't think I have PTSD, but some other people, they think I do. But I think it's just a bad experience and you learn from it. But the thing is, in order to make it positive, then we need resources. And these resources are very, like, are scarce. And we also give it, like, it means the world. So we try to make the most out of it. So it just happens that these two very fine guys that we're talking to are both on the receiving end of our
very fine guys.
David and Robert.
Yeah.
They are one of the select few because I'm targeting very effective forces that actually makes a difference for a much bigger frame that has a wider impact than just surviving on their own. People that save other people. So, because it's just, the war needs endless funds and we have limited. So we try to invest it in the most effective way possible.
And just pulling people out of Gaza for a barbecue
is absolutely a perfect way.
It's not just showing thanks, but it actually is an important ability for professional combatants to reset their...
Getting to as many people as possible. Like the support per buck, for example, is maybe the most effective with writing letters and sending even an M&M's bag, you know, with a letter to a soldier in the middle of nowhere. And we've done that, and it was blessed. It was truly blessed.
Okay.
And I know it sounds surprising, but there still are needs and there still are ways to take part in this. And I want to thank you for all the support you gave us throughout this very challenging time. I never know if I'll be there for the next project, but I hope I will. And you did a lot of good. All the people supporting you did a lot of good. Actively saved lives, not just in battle, but also. But, you know, a body cannot exist without a soul.
Yeah.
And many of our souls are worn out. We know it. We logically understand what's going on. We know it's all a show. We know they don't see it the same way, but still seeing what they do, what they did, it weighs down on you.
Yeah.
So lifting people up, being there for them, supporting them with the small things like a fan in the summer, you know, that drives air under your shirt and you can actually live, or just moves the fly away. Small things like that. It makes you feel like a human being again. And allows you to proceed another day and another day, and then it becomes a week and a month and a year. But all you need to break down is a single moment.
Yeah.
That's a single day.
Good.
And that's it.
Thank you. Thank you. So with that, again, anyone listening, following, who wants to get involved, to donate, your church, your synagogue, individually, your business, there are an infinite number of projects that we can be involved with. But if you want to come visit, we want you to come visit. And if you want to be a person collecting notes from your community, or something else, donating fans, we'll make that happen. Robert, David, Shaha, really, thank you. I apologize that in bringing the three of you on with all of your expertise, and there's so much more, I know you could say that we really only scratched the surface, but I think it's a super important conversation, especially now, as we're facing the headlines, literally, that we are. And before we know it, we're going to be 2 months into this thing. 2 years, excuse me. Thank you for taking your time out. And again, stay safe and be effective. As we always have for the last 4 years of this podcast, the Genesis 123 Foundation wants to thank you as well for following and offer you a special incentive to keep doing so. We call it From Jonathan's Bookshelf, and all we ask is that you like, comment on, or share the link to this broadcast. And every month we pick someone to receive a free copy of a special book that we have been giving out now for most of the last 4 years. And for the last 2 years, that book has been our book, Israel the Miracle, that we published just before the war began and could not be more meaningful or relevant. It's called Israel the Miracle. You can see it at israelthemiracle.com. It's of $75 value, but we're going to offer you one for free just for commenting, liking, or sharing the link to this program. We're grateful that the podcast is always sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. If you're ever in the area, I encourage people to pop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And special thanks as well to the Coyne family for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all the Genesis 123 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue the dialogue and building bridges. This episode, in honor of all of the fighters, whether they're behind a gun, in a trench, or in a bunker managing much of the intelligence and execution of this war, with thanks, with prayers for safety and continued success. If you'd like to sponsor an episode in honor or memory of or of a special event or a special occasion or loved one, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. And as always, we'd love to hear your comments as part of a dialogue and invite you to send comments specifically to our Ask the Rabbi programs. So if you have questions, please don't hesitate. Please do share this with others who will also find it of interest and continue to join us right here as we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics relating to Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy, and I send my blessings from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you. Hallelujah.